Welcome back to Token Insights and welcome to our series, Voices of Market Research. For this special episode, we have Bell Kirchhoff-Barnell, a researcher, editor, and community organizer with a strong background in anthropology, political science, and market research. Bell, thank you so much for being here. You are a known face at SMR. You were part already of an episode like a year, more than a year ago, I think. Where you talk like about language evolution, but you also did a training this past December on writing brand campaigns that includes and are for everyone. And when we started working on this season and this new series, I immediately have like, okay, we need to contact Bell because there's no better person to like, her work is so fascinating. And even like before this recording, like before I start person recording, we were talking about like everything that you're doing. And it's so interesting, like the way that you try to include everybody. And so I'm always fascinated for your work. So thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's really, it's always great to discuss these things and to bring these things together.
Before we started recording, you were mentioning a work that you were doing in South Africa, in a South African conference. Yeah. The RIM Research Forum, and you worked with something about the wine industry and women working in the wine industry. Tell me everything. What's all this about?
Cool. This is a nice place to start. So it was for the Race in the Marketplace Network. It was their third research forum, and they chose Cape Town because it's a fascinating place to discuss racial dynamics, but especially thinking about marketplaces, services, products, and consumers. There was a lot of discussion with us as a program committee about whether or not we would show a film as part of the conference opening, and we found a film about women, working class women in the countryside in the kind of Cape Town area who work in vineyards and their rights. And, you know, not just from a kind of economic point of view, but also climate justice, their rights as women and their rights as colored and black women as well within the South African context. So we were thinking about the marketplace in a very different way. So not just the consumer rights, but also the worker rights. And as part of that, we brought in women experts who are all kind of working in and around the wine industry in the South African context. So they talked about climate justice and reports that are being done and research that's being done that shows how these women are exposed to really dangerous pesticides that are banned in Europe, for instance. We looked at and had really amazing conversations about how difficult it is for Black-owned and Black women-owned wine brands to be sold in supermarkets or to be kind of exported around the world. And that, you know, the leading brands are still, you know, these apartheid age brands. You know, these are landowners. They got the land through the apartheid system, and they're still the leading brands. And we talked about, you know, financial literacy and education and getting access to, I think, services and spaces that we take for granted. They're really considered luxuries in this context. So it was really important to have those conversations, I think, especially all of us very privileged academics coming from outside and coming into South Africa to understand the local context and to understand what the marketplace and what the consumer and what the worker means, you know, with all these dynamics going on. So I took away a lot from that, not just as an organizer, but as someone listening to these four incredible women. And the film, I should mention the film, it was called Everyone Together. And it was about the work of Women on Farms, which is an organization based in South Africa.
Okay. Well, if you can send me the trailer or more information on the movie, I'll link it on the show notes. And it's really interesting, like, so what were some of the main takeaways from these women? Like, what were they trying to, or what do you think could change or needs to change? I mean, apart from not working with those pesticides and working in a more inclusive environment, I guess. But what were like the main takeaways of it?
Yeah, I mean, the climate action and, you know, protecting people, protecting workers, and either, you know, removing the pesticides or ensuring that the conditions are safe, you know, protective coverings and these kind of things. That was a very clear outcome. I think, yeah, you could see that there is a real need for more support and promotion of Indigenous brands. So we were joined by Ndumi Pikashe, who has her own brand. She's a winemaker, and her brand is called, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, Fekele Wines, and that means we have arrived. And it was incredible to me that she's faced this many barriers in launching her brand, or not launching it, but kind of taking it to the next level as a business. And one of the key reasons was that she used an indigenous brand name instead of an English, you know, a kind of old German or Dutch sounding name, which you see on a lot of, you know, I'm sure if you go now to Albert Heijn here in the Netherlands and you go to the wine place and you look for South African wines, it's all Dutch, German, English. And she used an indigenous South African name for her brand. And that's what been one of the barriers. And again, not necessarily from consumers, but from stores that would carry the brand, or, you know, it's an industry thing. It's like an old boys club. And at the same time, it felt very familiar as well, if I think about brands. To kind of come back to your question, what I came away with was that racism and sexism, in this case, is both for women in business. It materializes and manifests maybe in different ways depending on the context. So there's a very strong post-colonial scenario happening here about land ownership and who gets to make decisions and who's taken seriously and all of that stuff. But a lot of the arguments and the rationale are the same, especially when we start kind of really pulling away and having these conversations and interrogating. So I think that there's a lot of work we can do as a global community to support each other and show solidarity, because actually once we start really having a conversation, we see that the dynamics, they're quite alike, or they're comparable. And so we can support each other with different strategies and so on.
And all this talk that you were saying about the wines, like, I come from Portugal, like the wine industry there is very big, but it's at the same time very small, in the sense that no one kind of knows, or like people know about Portuguese wines, but it's not like a global brand or that you can find like pretty much everywhere. Like a bunch of other countries, like South Africa, you can find South African wines in a bunch of places, Chilean, Argentinian, there's a bunch of wines from around the world. Portuguese still not as much, but in the country, it's really, really big. Everyone drinks wine, everyone knows wine. Okay. And if you go to the supermarket, there's like a lot of brands. And it was kind of, I was thinking about like the wording that you use on the labels and the names, because we have a bunch of labels there and they kind of are meaningless, or they're just like names of persons, or they're just one word because it's fun and pretty and cool to have that, but they don't really have a meaning. Or they're not linked to something real and important in some sense. I bet there's gonna be like one or some brands that do actually have a meaning and it's important, but the generality of it, it's just names. And so I would like to link it, and I would ask you, like, the power of these narratives and the power of brands and the power of the names that you choose and the power of the way that you position yourself and your brands to tell the message, like, because that's kind of important. That's like something that should be very important when deciding the name of a brand, right?
Well, I mean, I'm editing some fabulous papers right now for Latam, and that's coming through in some of them. The story behind names of brands, that the intentionality, the legacy, the heritage, and how that then comes through in the campaigns that those brands have for their products or for their services, that's an integral part of the story. It's coherent. And so
the monopolies and the big brands and the money changes a lot. It's said that there's not an opportunity for outside and even inside people of the country and these brands to have a word and have a voice within their industry.
Well, I would say like a mainstream industry, because right now she does have a fabulous boutique industry. And if you are in South Africa and you are in contact with her, then you can buy the wine. It's just a shame you cannot go to, again, like a general, like a Woolworths, and buy the wine, just like any other brand.
I get what you're saying. Like, it's to have a brand, it's not just to have a shiny new thing. It's not just to have, I created a wine, I created whatever it is, like I created a dress, whatever it is. It's not just I created a brand. It should have, if you so agree to do it in that sense, but I feel like it should have a meaning behind it. Like, it should have a why. And that's kind of why market research, it kind of exists to give you all of that. But then you can use all of those to that market research as to find all of those meaningful things and the ways and whys behind it. But I feel like sometimes brands and clients and researchers are not looking into that, are not looking into why do it and why call it this and why do it like this.
Yeah.
What's the meaning behind it? Why should I call it X and not Y? And why is X so important for the history of and the context of the country and the planet and whatever you want to say? But I feel sometimes people forget that they also can have a voice and they also can have, they can also say something with their brands.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think that that's kind of what the work of Race in the Marketplace as a network interrogates, is that tension between, you know, the kind of, I suppose, ROI priorities, not just of the client, the, you know, the brand, but also the market researcher. And that's kind of how, so, you know, I'm part of the European Race and Imagery Foundation. That's how we got to know RIM or Race in the Marketplace. We presented our research at their forum that they had in Paris in 2019, because our research has been tracking for the last 10 years how different Dutch brands, Dutch and Belgian brands, pitch their Sinterklaas products, and how do they tell the story of Sinterklaas, and how does that move as cultural attitudes around Sinterklaas, and specifically the image of Zwarte Piet. How is that changing? And how do different brands play with that? Because this is a very strong narrative that you can't just ignore it. It has to be kind of integral to the development of the product and how it's sold, because, you know, you have kids believing in this. So we were very struck by this. On one hand, you have a growing campaign to completely change the story in order to not discriminate against Black people. And on the other hand, you have, of course, the commercial, quote-unquote commercial priorities of how do we continue to sell products then, you know? Is that going to affect the, you know, is this going to affect the profitability of our Sinterklaas merchandise if we change it? And it's been really interesting to follow that. You know, we had a couple of years where we thought, oh, maybe there's nothing new to say, but actually, With the last election just over a year ago in the Netherlands, we started to see some pretty interesting shifts.
And not enough people are talking about it, and not enough people are putting the effort to understanding, like, the whys. And again, like, what happens if we change something? What happens if we, instead of selling like this, sell this way? You know, I was going to ask you about some challenges and what challenge have you faced when combining and working in both activism and research? And it's kind of going on what you were saying, but like, what are some of the most or the biggest challenge that you faced so far?
Oh, that's such a big question. I think generally speaking, I would say that one of the biggest challenges that most activist scholars face is getting the stuff published, because I would say that most of the main journals, it's changing slowly, but a lot of journals, they don't necessarily want something so sharp. And I think with activist scholarship, there is always a very strong message behind what you're saying. You're not going to come with just general theory. It's not necessarily just, you know, present your findings and onto the next thing. There is a mission behind what you're doing. So I think that is there. I hear that from colleagues. And one of the ways we address it is to create our own spaces. That is one of the things that Race in the Marketplace does, which is very important and very crucial. It's one of the things that we've been doing with the European Race and Imagery Foundation. There are lots of organizations like this. There's the European Network Against Racism, which is doing this more and more, especially with their DEI and academic communities. So I think having those spaces is essential, being able to publish our own stuff, being able to organize conferences where we can be together and brainstorm and have these very important conversations and continue to grow and to learn. Being able to teach this within universities is, you know, a challenge and a barrier. Especially these days, that's becoming more and more challenging, actually, rather than less challenging, so that you can at least pass on critical thinking tools to students so that they can make up their own minds. You know, being able to democratize resources that they're exposed to, the literature that they're exposed to, being able to offer different interpretations and versions of history. These are actually things that are, instead of becoming less challenging, as I hoped as I was graduating, you know,
it's 15 odd
years ago, it's becoming more of a challenge. But I wouldn't 100% agree that there's few people doing this work. I think there are a lot of us, but we're often deliberately or both deliberately and unintentionally marginalized and kept out of mainstream spaces. And I think this is why I'm so invested always in more collaboration between, like, let's say, commercial market researchers, but also the more academic or scholarly marketing sciences community, because I think we can achieve a lot together.
And speaking of students and academia and young researchers, I was going to ask if you have an advice for all of them, when and especially for using their skills and the things that they're learning today in the university and their work, or if they're in the workforce or whatever, like using those skills for social goods. What advice would you give them?
I'm more interested to see what they can teach us. Actually, from the teaching that I do, I see so much compassion and patience and self-awareness from students these days, far more than I remember from when I was a student. It seems to come so naturally to students these days, actually. So I suppose that's a generational thing, and that's the world that we live in. One of the concerns I think I have and colleagues have is the overexposure to technology and AI. And on one hand, it's very much like we have to move with the times and we have to learn to work with it. And it's just like, you know, 20, 25 years ago when everybody suddenly had a computer and we had to learn how to live with that. And then everybody had the internet and we had to learn to, and then smartphones and social media. But it's so pervasive. And it's so matter of fact that you just have to live with this. And I remember it being such a huge conversation 10 years ago in market research too. Like, how do we handle big data? And that probably sounds like such an archaic term right now. But then it was like, big data, how are we going to handle it as a market research community? Are we, you know, is it de facto that we now do all of our qual via social media? Is that the way it's going? You know, that we were having these conversations and now I feel like that conversation's happening with AI. And so as much as I know that market research, like scholars are figuring that out, like, how do we do that? How do we incorporate that? How do we not become replaceable? I think also for students, it's like, what do I do with this? Do I need to use it? If I use it, you know, in what way? I'm like, be very careful with technology. Be very careful with how many logins you have. Be very careful with the platforms that you use and what you expose yourself to. Make sure that you have a good balance, that if you're that you don't get all of your news from one source, that you do not spend so much of your time and energy being present and visible on these platforms, that you are also spending a lot of time in the real world and away from a screen. And that might all sound very preachy and very grandma-like, but this is what I'm seeing. When we see anxiety and when we see tensions with our students, it's usually something to do with technology. They live in a WhatsApp group instead of physically being present in the common room where they can see people and be in touch with people. They really rely on what ChatGPT tells them is a good argument rather than figuring out how to structure it themselves and maybe letting ChatGPT help them with the grammar. You know what I mean? Do you want to follow what I'm saying? So I'm like,
it's a tool at the end of the day. It's a tool. You need to know how to use it, but
it should be a human part. But there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure. And it's not to do, it's two things. There's the pressure of being perfect, getting everything right the first time. And there's the pressure of understanding every type of technology there is. And It's like you're in higher education to continue to expand your mind and to try things out and to grow as an individual, not to be this perfect product at the end. It is okay if you don't have everything figured out at the end. That's what education is about. And whether you're going to go on to further education at the end or whether you're going to go out and get a job and you hope this diploma will help you, you're still a work in progress. You will be for your whole life. And I think all of these technological advancements that we've witnessed, I would say probably for the last 50 years, I think that they're just promoting this myth that perfection is attainable and that that's something we should strive for rather than just continuing to learn and grow and live. And that's my biggest chunk of wisdom to the young.
Absolutely.
And something that I tell myself as well. But seriously, like, just, you know, all of the compassion and patience that I talked about, you know, like that they're able to give to others, give to yourself, and enjoy the ride, not just focus on the destination. Yeah,
absolutely. That's why I barely answer my WhatsApp calls. I'm kidding. But I get what you're saying, and I do agree with it, and I feel like everyone's so connected and so in the moment, and we always have a phone in hand, like, yeah, all the times. Like, I don't have mine here because it's charging. Otherwise, it would be somewhere here in the vicinity of this desk, and it's always here. We don't need this device all the time, because this also brings that, like, the comparisons and the relying on all these tools to be perfect, when maybe we shouldn't be as reliable on this. Like, you should just live in the moment, live in the real world, and then use all these tools to help facilitate your work and all of that. I have one more question that I'm really curious about, which is, if you have to choose, what would you be, like, one of your favorite projects that you worked on so far in your career?
That's difficult. It's difficult because I just got back, like I said, from South Africa, and that was amazing. And I had a lot of fun helping with that conference. And I love the teaching that I get to do. And, you know, IRF is like such a big piece of my heart. And I'm so proud of what we've been able to do. I think what I can say is that what ties pretty much everything together, I'm going to get out of answering the question directly. It's counterintuitive, right? Because I'm self-employed, so I work on my own a lot. But what I tend to enjoy the most about every project that I do, and at the moment I'm in a very blessed position that everything I work on right now I love. What I like is the collaborative side of it. That is the joy I take out of it. So whether I'm working on the research that we do at IRF, or whether we're curating a collection of written pieces by others, and we're working with illustrators and we're working with translators, or whether I'm working on papers at SMR and I'm going back and forth with the authors, so what did you mean here, and is this a better terminology, and maybe we could, I love working with people and putting something together and making sure that the meaning is clear and that it has intention and that it serves its purpose. And I think, yeah, you know, same with events, you know, it was everything from the thinking about the food, to thinking about music, to thinking about who to have on the panel, to the program, to where to put different things in order. I just really, really enjoyed being able to kind of work on that with people and then be there at the event and just see all these different people connect and hear all of these stories come to life and see all of this incredible content and people kind of staying in touch afterwards, you know, hearing from people, oh, I've just had a Teams call with this person and I'm reading this paper from, and it's just like, yeah, you know, this happens organically in the right conditions, but it's a blessing to be able to work on a team and collaborate with people and see that kind of magic come out of something that you were able to do. And I can't do that by myself, you know. But, you know, I think that the kind of human collaboration is vital. It's the only way we can solve all of these social problems that we always come back to talking about. So for me, that's it. Being able to create these spaces and opportunities for people to collaborate and to improve and to make things better, whatever topic that is.
Such a great answer. Thank you. And Belle, it's really been a pleasure having you on the podcast and the conversation and explaining what you do and everything, the intersection between research and activism and your social impact is really inspiring me.
Well,
every time that, I talk to you, it's, I don't know, I always feel really inspiring.
Thank you. Thank you for including me. This is just one voice. So, but thank you. And yeah, I've said it before, you know, I do see that happening, actually. If I really compare, you know, when I first was working with SMR years ago in the office and working on Research World when it was still a paperback magazine, rather than this incredible platform that you're helping to kind of continue to develop. And I'm seeing it in the papers. I'm seeing it in the research. It's happening. So I think, let's link up. Let's collaborate more, you know, let's see what we can all do together. And yeah, I think we will get there.
Before I leave you, I just wanted to say that next month, from April 1st to April 3rd, SMR will be in Latin America, more specifically in Lima, for the SMR Latin America Conference. This year's theme, Altitudes, promises to take your knowledge and networking to new heights. So don't miss on the beautiful presentations, the wonderful workshops, and a chance to connect with professionals from around the area and the globe. Plus, there's like a stunning backdrop of Lima, cultural foods, and breathtaking landscapes. You just can't miss it. It's a great way to know more about this beautiful region. So register now to secure a spot. You can visit the links in the description of this episode for all the details. And I'll see you in Lima. And I also want to thank everyone involved in the making of this episode. Please like and subscribe. And for me, that's all. I'll see you on the next one. Bye.